Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate that you listen to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and also leave us some feedback. Rate us. Give us a review. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano. Raw. Sourced. Fresh. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, built by high-caliber millwrights, this is The Bald-Faced Truth.
Been talking a lot about sneakers today, more than I'm comfortable with. We need a change of pace. We're going to football. Mike Leach, Washington State head football coach. What kind of footwear are you wearing today?
I am wearing Olukai flip-flops, which are outstanding. Those are the best ones. My second favorite would be Kobians. It's a little challenging to initially spend actual money on flip-flops, and I resisted it for years. But it's worth it. You got to spend it. And then Olukai gives you like a crazy long guarantee, which is excellent. And then, spend money on flip-flops. If flip-flops are, if you're a big flip-flop guy and you're a flip-flop wearer, spend the money and then get good ones. When I was a kid, it's funny, I just saw a movie. When I was a kid, you know, you'd elevate from JCPenney's tennis shoes to Converse All-Stars. Everybody had Converse All-Stars. And it's because you didn't have any other choices. You'd wear Converse All-Stars. Okay, then there was a place where you hit a fork in the road, and I liked both of them. And you were either a Nike Cortez guy or an Adidas Sheltoe guy. And I had them both, and they're both outstanding. They're both hard to wear out, the Sheltoe especially.
We're talking to Mike Leach, Washington State head football coach. Where are you right now? What's that background that we're hearing?
I'm just traveling around, walked by a place where they're playing a little music and stuff. Pullman's got a bunch of snow, it was funny because we didn't have any snow, no snow, really cold, but not much snow, kind of one storm before January, and then not much in January, then February hits, and they made up for lost time, just one after the next.
What's going on with this class that you're teaching? It's warfare and football and... I'm fascinated by this, and I noticed it has its own Twitter handle. So what's going on with this class?
Well, basically, it's I got a guy, a friend of mine. He was a state senator. He worked for the State Department. He's actually taught classes in insurgency and counterinsurgency. And so we got to talking one day about commingling football with it. And then, in both football and counterinsurgency, there's goals, there's objectives, there's stuff that's defended and fortified. There's stuff that you have to attack and secure. There's ground that you got to take. There's ground and things that you can compromise, but then there's others that you have to have. And the thought was to talk a little bit about kind of time and space, to achieve those kind of territory type of goals, and between football and counterinsurgency. It sounds interesting. I think it'll be good. I think it'll be anybody working together as a team work together to achieve goals that. One or two receiver has to attack this chunk of space, so you spread out their fortification. Another receiver attacks this piece of space. The running back's here, so it goes. And you know, you're behind your wall of offensive linemen, and you know, and anyway, so I do think it'll be interesting. So it'll be, you know, we'll present a phase of each side, the counterinsurgency side, the football side, and then open it to discussion. And I guess the part I'm most excited about is the discussion on it, really.
We're talking to Mike Leach, Washington State football coach. I'm fascinated by underdogs and why teams win, and they're, you know, the parallels between sports and war. All you have to do is watch NFL films, and it's a battlefield, and everything is a, you know, everything is about the military and being in the trenches, and you got a field general at quarterback. And a lot of people say, hey, you shouldn't talk that way, but I love the strategy stuff. Do you see like direct parallels between preparation that you can read historically for battles and preparation for football?
Well, I think, you know, I never really make parallel, like, I mean, comparisons like, you know, football's war or wars like football. I never really do that because I think it's disrespectful to war, but I do think that, you know, there is a teamwork involved, both cases. There's teamwork involved. One guy's relying on the next, and you're trying to choreograph a lot of moving parts at the same time. So I think there's some elements that are definitely similar and the same, and you know, that are interesting to draw from, and you can learn from as well. Like, you know, there's always a plan going in, and the plan going in, almost without exception, it's never perfect because, you know, the other guy's working too. And then you have to adjust and, you know, do alternative things. And then at the end you debrief, you know, if you're in the military, or in our case, you know, you pour over film and see what you can learn from it and go on to the next one. So I do think as far as organizing and the teamwork and bringing a group together, I do think there's definitely some similarities.
Is it tough to get into that class? Is it all full?
Right now they're having essays to get into that, the thing. I think they're having essays. They're trying to limit it to 40. And then, you know, and we kind of got this thing together quite suddenly. And so then, so they're putting it together quickly. And I think we'll know more once we learn how this one works exactly, you know.
This last season, I thought you guys had a great season. Maybe you wish it wouldn't have snowed so much in Pullman for that conference, that deciding game with you guys in Washington. I sure would have liked to have seen that game with good weather. But how did you feel coming out of that season, coming out of that year? Because everybody said you were a surprise. Everybody pointed out where you were picked. But, you know, you had to look back at that and go, hey, that was a really nice season.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought that, you know, you always just do the best you can one at a time and try to win as many of them as you can. And I thought we did a pretty good job of that. The pick part, I thought we were going to be pretty good. And I think we'll be pretty good this year, too. And we have a lot of people back. But, you know, if you have a pretty good locker room, you know, that helps a lot. I mean, if you got a good locker room of guys that are supportive and push one another, and then, you know, you're not coaching the same stuff twice all the time, you know?
What's the key to developing that locker room culture, that atmosphere?
Well, you definitely have to convert some key players. And then the thing is if they, especially guys that bought in early, is the message builds with them over, you know, 3 to 5 years, say. And then, you know, and they become kind of the voices in the locker room, then that's awfully strong to overcome if you're kind of, you know, one of those guys that wants to be dissatisfied or not like try to go against the locker room. That's difficult because, you know, the thing is coaches may have the authority thing. And as in, you know, I can make you run or I can cut you from the team or something like that. But, you know, but coaches are only there once in a while, you know, because they don't see coaches all the time, but they see their peers all the time. And, you know, if they're doing something that's not satisfactory to their peers and the peers make it be known, then that's awfully tough for a guy to overcome, you know, then usually they end up integrating themselves and abiding with everybody else. Sometimes they leave, you know, but, and I think that's what's key. And then, you know, I guess one example would be, so when you first go in, make a big deal out of the academics and everything, you know, you make the academic guys stand up and point out that they're not doing their part and, you know, they're hurting the team because they skipped this many classes and that type of deal. And I stand them up, too, and I don't hesitate to do that. And then, you know, initially when you first take over a team, it's snicker, snicker, ha-ha, well, you know, then after a while, but then when it gets to where juniors and seniors make it clear that they're upset with freshmen or even an occasional sophomore or JC guy for not going to class where, hey, you know, we don't put up with that here. No, you take care of that. Then you're really starting to get somewhere. Then it's like, you know, then people are looking at a more bigger view of what's important. Like, for example, you know, I mean, you can be some All-American whatever, or you can be a scout team guy, okay? But if all of a sudden you have to miss practice or you're distracted from practice, can't go to practice because, you know, you have to write a paper that you put off or you have to make up for a class that you failed to go to, well, we're a worse team. I mean, we're not then working with the scout team player that we want to be working with. The All-American guy, he's not out there to help make himself and his teammates better, and it's just selfish. And I think that when it starts to get looked at that way, I think you get stronger and stronger as a team. And I think, just thinking out loud, because, you know, there's going to be a point where I got to figure out what I'm going to say in this class. that applies to that situation too. You know, to whether it's the military or trying to combat insurgencies. You know,
I have one of my guilty pleasures is I got to have coffee every day. I can't go without the coffee. What's Mike Leach's vice?
You know, I've had one cup of coffee in the last 2 weeks, and I'm fairly pleased with myself on that. And I like what coffee does. I've always thought coffee tastes horrible. And then, like all this, you know, dump this in it, dump that in it. if you have a bowl full of dog manure and you add a bunch of sugar to it, then all you have is sweet dog manure, you know? And I do like those shots of Cuban coffee. I do miss that. So I tried to, one, because then my mouth didn't taste as bad, but then two, because I think, and I know there's material goes both ways, there's material all over the map on this thing, that tea's a little better for you. So I drink tea. I drink tea in excess throughout the course of the day. I drink more tea than a person should drink. It's probably bad for me. But that's what I do. I drink tea.
Yeah, and do you live in the off season in Key West? Is that where you go?
If I can get, depending, I mean, I try to, well, it's a combination of, I try to sort of check off bucket list items around the world, you know, and get checks where I can. And then, so I might be doing that, or then the decompress places is Key West, you know, where you catch up on the sleep, where, you know, you alleviate the stress. And it's far enough away, though. I need at least a week to go, you know.
Yeah. And how did you pick Key West? Did you just visit there once and you said, ah, this is the place? Or what was that?
Let me think here. Back in like 89, I think it was. Okay, so I was at Iowa Wesleyan College, and so we'd go recruiting. And when you went recruiting there, they didn't have the budget to bring you back. So you'd go recruiting, and me and another coach, we'd drive in his car, drive, get to a spot. And a lot of times we used, timeshares.
Yeah.
Somebody'd have a timeshare. So we'd use timeshare somebody had, and say go to Atlanta, timeshare. Then I'd rent a car. I'd go one direction. He'd go his direction. And go recruiting. Well, then you hit the weekend. They didn't have the budget to bring you back home. And so since they didn't have the budget to bring you back home, those schools were open over the weekend. So you'd have to find places to go and ways to kill time. So, you know, take about a month. But so you'd start out, we'd start out at Mount Pleasant, Iowa, go through Missouri, hit a few stops in Missouri, hit some stops in Alabama and Georgia, then work our way down to Florida, and then South Florida. So South Florida, I finished up with Dade County High School in South Dade, Homestead High in South Dade. And then, you know, it's the weekend, so I drive to Key West. And that was the first time I'd ever been to Key West. Then I stayed in the Econo Lodge, which the Econo Lodge isn't here anymore. The hurricane got it, so they made it something else. And so then, so as I'm sitting there in the Econo Lodge, I'm thinking, well, there's got to be a high school here. And so then I called down to the front desk, and the girl had gone to high school. And she says, yeah. She goes, well, I'll tell him you want to get a hold of him, and maybe he'll call you. And so the head football coach called me. He says, yeah, let's go downtown. We'll have a fish sandwich. So we go downtown, got to know him, ended up going fishing that weekend, had a great time, ended up getting a kicker from Key West High. All the way to Iowa Wesleyan College, Key West High. The kicker would go up there. He'd go up there, and his family would come when they had two games back-to-back, you know, when we had two home games back-to-back. They'd fly in from Key West. They'd go to Walmart. They'd buy some cheap, warm clothing from Walmart. They'd wear it for that week, you know, watch the first game, watch the second game. Then just leave the stuff, fly back to Key West. And so then and he eventually went with us to Valdosta. When we transferred to Valdosta, this guy went with us to Valdosta State. From then on, I've come down here like I'd come down here like 1 to 3 times a year ever since. And then in 2009, I bought a house down here.
Does the stories of Ernest Hemingway or Tennessee Williams, that's what I think about Key West. Do you feel like, are there landmarks for Hemingway in Tennessee?
Oh, yeah. There's people that actually know Tennessee. There's people that know Tennessee because, you know, he was here later than Hemingway. There's some old guys that know Hemingway or his kids or somebody. But, so Hemingway's house is here. I actually know the hotel he stayed in when he first got here, which a lot of people don't, but I know where that is. So his house, which is an outstanding tour, even if you're not interested in Hemingway, it's worth it because, just a really cool mansion that time period, and the lot's cool. And see, Hemingway was famous when he got here.
Yeah.
And then he used to hang out in this bar called, it was called Sloppy Joe's. It actually was called the Blind Pig, I think. And then it became Sloppy Joe's because a guy named Joe Russell ran the bar, who was Hemingway's buddy who he went fishing with all the time. And then, so then, you know, they decide the lease is too high and the guy, the landlord, wouldn't repair anything. And so, so they, well, and so when the lease lapsed or whatever, Joe Russell bought the one that's Sloppy Joe's now, which is half a block away. And everybody picked up, had all the people in his bar say, grab something, carry it here, and I'll give you a free drink. And so they moved it over there. And then Hemingway, see the opening part of the book, To Have and To Have Not, which that's the one book he wrote that's set in Key West. If you think about it, and this is interesting, and I hadn't thought about it, and I'd read Hemingway for a long time. The only book that Hemingway book, and I'm not talking about the Nick Adams stories, which are short stories, but the only book that Hemingway ever wrote that's set in America is To Have and To Have Not. And that's set in Key West. And you can argue about whether that's totally America or it isn't, you know. And so Captain Tony's is that bar where it talks about him looking out and he can see the people as they walk by. They can't see him because, you know, he's sitting in there in the dark. And it sounds like he used to run across, you know, people in there as they're passing through, get their story, jot down some notes, kind of file it away. And sometimes, you know, the scene or the story or the personality of the person would appear in his novels.
Are the cats still running around? Because he had a seven-toed cat, and somebody told me that descendants of that cat are all around Key West. Like, when you look at the cats, they have seven toes.
Well, the ones over there at the Hemingway house, most of them do, not all. Some have seven. Generally, it's six. So it's like a cat foot, but it looks like a catcher's mitt, you know?
Wow.
And so regular cat, and extra toes. So it's like real wide, you know. It's like one of those old school catcher's mitt, not one of those streamlined ones they do now.
Yeah.
Where from some weird political correct standpoint, the catcher has to feel like he's kind of like the second baseman or the shortstop. So they're going to make his glove look as much like theirs as they possibly can. No, it's not like that. It's like, no, this one's fat and clumpy. And so, so then, the cats are there, and they're named after celebrities that Hemingway encountered and stuff. And then, let's see, what other Hemingway stuff? Well, see, and so, and then he met Martha Gellhorn in Captain Tony's, and then, of course, he takes up with her, and then they were briefly married, and she was, all his wives were journalists of some sort, and then that didn't last very long. They were, like, you know, just very combustible, and they moved to Cuba. Oh, I've been to his place in Cuba, too, which is weirdly kind of set up like his one in Key West, but there's quite a lot of Hemingway stuff. Like, they'll have Hemingway days, and so these guys, they have a Hemingway look-alike contest. So all these older, stocky guys come down here. They grow their beard out, and it's kind of wild. It's pretty hilarious, actually. But so you'll go downtown, and all of a sudden there's all these older guys with Hemingway beards, and then they kind of morph into Hemingway. So they're all rude, and they, you know, you might catch an elbow here or something as you're walking through a crowd, or, you know, they. And so it's really pretty hilarious, but yeah, they'll try to be Hemingway. And then, it's cool. There's a lot of his history here. And also the bulk of his work was done here. They got, like, his typewriters, his fishing poles, some of his, you know, the animals he shot, you know, from Africa and things. There's another museum that's not as famous as his house called the Custom House. And on the top floor of that, there's a ton of Hemingway relics up there. And they, it's kind of like it's, I guess it's government or something. And they don't advertise it like they potentially could. But as far as, you know, the house is one place. And as far as personal possessions, there's probably more in the custom house.
Mike Leach, I look forward to talking to you in front of college football season. I got to see Key West now because I'm a big Hemingway fan. And now I'm going to have to go to Key West.
Well, I'll be here in July. So if you get, if you're here in July at some point, then I'll take you around.
All right. I love it. Tour with Mike Leach. You could, you know, when you retire, you could sell tours of Key West.
I could get a little bitty trolley, not like the big one that shows you around town, which that's worth seeing too, because there's a lot of these houses and things, but that, and that's worth seeing too. But, I could get a little bitty trolley, kind of more like a tuk-tuk, you know?
Yep. I love it.
You know, the one where the motorcycle's attached to the carriage that holds, basically four people, but six if you really overload it, you know?
Beautiful. Thank you for coming on.
All right, Bubba. Great to be on.
All right. There he is. Washington State football coach Mike Leach on Seven-Toed Cats, Ernest Hemingway, and much more. Flip-flops. What else do we talk about? Leave it right here. We'll talk recruiting. Still ahead. I sort of have to go to Key West, Florida now with Mike Leach, don't I? I mean, isn't that a foregone conclusion? I want to thank everybody. On yesterday's show, we had Dave Deckert from Blazers Edge, who came on talking about Blazers Edge Night, Trailblazers game, they wanted to basically arrange for as many kids as possible in our community who were in need of a night out. Blazers Edge was successful in selling 2,222 tickets for the Blazers game on March 25th, when the Blazers play the Brooklyn Nets. I want to thank everybody who made a donation or gave this some publicity. And, of course, Blazers Edge. Now, Peter, you've got something to do with Blazers Edge. What do you do with Blazers Edge?
Yeah, I write a Monday column. I've been with them for a couple years. Every once in a while, I'll do some news editing and stuff like that, but mostly it's just a feature piece.
All right, so you've been with them a couple years. I have to say my history with Blazers Edge hasn't always been a kind one.
Sure.
Like I'm critical of the team. Sometimes the people that run Blazers Edge have been critical of me for being critical of the team or disagreed with me. But I love that, like, we could set aside any differences we have and go, hey, this is a great cause. I love what Dave and the team are doing. Can you give us an idea for people like in Eugene and Klamath Falls who have no idea what we're talking about? What is Blazers Edge?
So Blazers Edge, it's essentially the internet's best Blazers site. It runs from essentially knowledgeable fans up to Ben Golliver with the Washington Post started with Blazers Edge. And we're going to give you everything you need to know about the Blazers.
And what is 2,222 tickets mean to you when you hear that?
I'll try not to get emotional, but this will be my fourth Blazers Edge night next month. And watching those kids, I mean, just seeing the look on their face when they walk out of the concourse and see the court for the first time, or you'll hear them whisper, that's Damian Lillard. That's
yeah.
And it takes you back. I don't know. I mean, I grew up with not a lot of money myself, and I can just really relate to just having that night out with no worries. I certainly wasn't in the position that some of these kids are on. They don't have great home lives. They don't.
Yeah.
And so for one night, they just get to be kids and have fun.
Yeah. Sometimes, and I relate to this with the BFT Foundation because I think we're serving a lot of the same kids in that. You're just trying to give some kids who's maybe the only normal they're getting is a co-curricular activity or a night out. The home life is not normal to them, or maybe they're amid dysfunction for a large portion of their day. And sometimes in cases with the Bald Faced Truth Foundation, it's just a summer camp or an after school program or running track or playing volleyball or playing a musical instrument that gives you a little bit of sanity. So I appreciate everybody at Blazers Edge and, of course, any listeners who made a donation. And if you didn't, maybe you're inspired to go out and try to make a difference in some small way. You can do that, too, by going to baldfacetruth.org if you want to support a kid in the community, and we obviously have Camp Exceptional coming up, and there are kids that cannot afford to attend Camp Exceptional. You can scholarship a kid for Camp Exceptional, the summer camp, by going to baldfacetruth.org and just clicking the donate button. It'll take you right to the links for summer camp donation. All right, leave it right here. Punch It Audio next.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.